Thank you. Just to clear up any possible misapprehension, I'm retired and I live in Chicago. I'm not actually living in retirement, but it's sort of a safe house under an assumed identity. There aren't many people now who know of the life and works of Clara Beadle, who was the editor of what, despite no doubt her many sterling qualities, was the worst cataloging code ever published and promulgated by respectable library organizations, the 1949 ALA cataloging rules. The history of committee codes goes back to 1908, of course, the Anglo-American cataloging rules, so-called, which even then contained differences between the British text and the American text. And things just limped along, not very much pressure on standardization. Most British libraries went on for 60 years using the 1908 rules for their what were then modern materials, despite the fact that many modern cataloging problems were completely ignored by the 1908 rules, obviously, and that they had extensive rules on such things as crestomathies, which is not an operation on the internal organs, but some kind of collection of essays. The Vatican rules came and stayed in the Vatican, more or less. The Second World War came, and from the rubble of the Second World War came the 1949 cataloging rules, which were really an accretion of cases. There was absolutely almost no principle behind it, no theory, no organizing theory. And it's typified by, I'm getting old, so I can't remember. I think it's Rule 159. It's some subsection of Rule 159 in the 1949 rules that dealt with only one institution, the Basilian Monastery at Mount Sinai. So if you were lucky enough to get a publication emanating from this place, you had a special rule telling you how to enter it. And you didn't have to be Seymour Lubetzky to see that there was something grievously wrong with this. Anything which was just an accretion of esoteric solved problems was not going to help you as new things came along. And what happened was the 1949 rules were just completely disregarded in outside North America. The 1950 Library of Congress rules for descriptive cataloging similarly were basically, they were instructions on how to construct a Library of Congress card, which is what cataloging aimed at in this country for many years. And there was a, by the mid to late 60s, or in fact the early 60s, there was clearly a need for a new code. The British needed something that was, that actually didn't just post-date the invention of flight, and the Americans needed a kind of coherent standard. At the same time, things like MARC were brewing. OCLC was brewing. It wasn't yet there. OCLC, I believe, started operation in the same year in the same town as Wendy's Hamburgers in 1968 in Columbus, Ohio. And there was a real pressure for standardization, both internally within the countries involved, but I think even more importantly, externally. Those of you as old as I am might remember that there were, for example, floods of books coming from South Asia into American libraries by virtue of various arrangements and treaties. And what was needed was some kind of standard cataloging data for these things. The Library of Congress was finding it increasingly difficult to keep up with the cataloging output required by the libraries of the United States. So there was automation, there's pressure for standardization, and so on. And the grand result of all of that was the first Anglo-American cataloging rules, actually not the first because of the 1908 rules, but it was called that. It came out in 1967. The British texts and the American, North American texts were very divergent, almost in very important areas, completely different. And that was because the Library of Congress, in its infinite lack of wisdom, had caused Seymour Lubetzky to be pushed out of the editor chair. It was edited by Sumner Spaulding, who was a very fine gentleman, but not, you know, the cutting-edge theoretician that Lubetzky was. And Lubetzky had already laid out in all his writings exactly how he should approach creating a principle-based cataloging code, not a case-based. And so that was a big mistake. The failure to reconcile the British and North American points of view. And when I say British, I'm not just speaking of my native land. It was the British text was used throughout what used to be the British Empire and almost all the rest of the English-speaking world. So if you wanted a step towards international standardization, you needed a text that was agreed to by all sides. So Anglo-American Cataloging Rules 1967 came out. It was adopted in Britain. The British text was adopted. But then Marx started up, and OCLC started up, and computerized catalogs came into view. And it became obvious that this kind of state of affairs, where you had a very flawed code in two radically different versions, was not suitable for this new age. You needed, the kind of people that bang on about metadata always talk about Marc cataloging. There is no such thing. Marc is a holding format, and what we're talking about here is the content. And so Marc was a standard holding format, but it didn't have standard content to go in it. And if any of you remember the early computerized catalogs that were made up of, computerized card records and new records using these flawed standards, and OCLC itself, as its database grew, somebody once said, cruelly, that it was the bibliographic equivalent of Lake Erie, which in those days was in the habit of catching fire. Or was it the Cuyahoga River? I can't remember. But anyway, it was a mess. And very quickly, by the late 70s, it was seen on both sides of the Atlantic, throughout the English-speaking world, we needed a standard code. A mechanism was set up to create such a code, the Joint Steering Committee, with representatives from the National Library Associations in Britain, Canada, and the United States, and by the national libraries of those three countries. One of the tasks was to incorporate the ISBD, which was first put out in 1971, I think, the ISBD for monographs. And it very rapidly became apparent in the course of working on the new rules that we needed an ISBD for everything, the ISBDG, so-called. Librarianship has a habit of being very firm about the principle of putting the cart before the horse. So we did the monographs and then extrapolated that to produce something that was hospitable to all media. The idea was to produce a code which was based on Lubetzkian principles, incorporated the ISBD, took note of computerized catalogs and computerized cataloging. And I think there were three huge errors made, mostly understandable, but some not. One was that not to involve Seymour Lubetzky, who was still at that time perfectly active. In fact, he lived for many more years after that, and I can tell you I attended his 100th birthday celebration, and I've had far less incisive conversations with people of 50. So he could have easily participated in it and would have brought, I think, an air of authority to it, because by that time everyone recognized that Lubetzky was right, that you needed a code that embodied principles, and you could work out the details and the cases if you could deduce from those principles. The second thing, the second grievous error, was pretending that this new code was a revision of the 1967 code. It was nothing of the sort. It was a completely new code on new principles, organized in a completely new way. Had they had the, and I say they because I was just a humble editor, the policies were taken, you might think they were taken by the Joint Steering Committee, they were not. They were taken in the National Libraries. The National Libraries determined that the profession would not stomach an entirely new code a decade after they'd already adapted to the previous one. So you had to pretend that this was a revision of it. Had they had the nerve to say, had they had the wisdom to foresee there was going to be a fuss anyway, so you might as well have a big fuss about something worth fussing about, they would have called it the new Anglo-American cataloging rules or something of that nature. And we probably wouldn't be standing here today, though I have great pleasure in being here, of course. I like speaking at what is in my head 7:30 in the morning. We probably wouldn't be here, because what we'd be discussing would be something like the third edition or the fourth edition of the new Anglo-American cataloging rules, or the new descriptive cataloging rules. Call it whatever you want. Call it George. So we'd be discussing George IV. There wouldn't be anything like the fuss. There wouldn't be anything like the need by the people who are currently doing the RDA to come up with new contrivances, to come up with something, quotes, completely different. And the third big mistake was to allow conservative, I mean small c, interests to dictate that the new code would contain substantial chunks of the old practice. What would have been much better would be to have a completely stripped down code that just gave principles. How you arrived at access points, what the description is, and so on. And then people interested in that kind of thing could produce manuals on how to catalog treaties using that, how to catalog liturgical works. And I think that that substantially weakened what ACR2 could have been, because it sort of delegitimized the enterprise. So here we've got a structure that's based on principle, but on the other hand, we're going to include page after page after page of how to catalog the Bible, how to do all kinds of esoteric things. And so there we were. It came out in 1978. There was huge pressure from the Association of Research Libraries, who'd heard that this was the downfall of Western civilization as we know it, was going to cost them fortunes, was going to blow up everything. I remember Lucia Rather giving a talk that brought tears to everyone in the room about how difficult it was to change a single heading in the Library of Congress card catalog. You know, it involved you know, boatloads of Egyptian slaves carrying cards from one building to another and so on. But anyway, so there was this terrible panic in the air. What are we going to do? How are we going to accommodate this dreadful thing? Not recognizing that the reason why it was going to be a big change was because their catalogs didn't really work very well and weren't user-friendly, weren't anything. You know, they were just a mess, particularly in the card form. And particularly if you worked, as I did shortly after, at a place like the University of Illinois that had a 9 million card catalog in, you know, the arc of the catalog in the center of the library, this ecclesiastical surroundings with these 9 million cards, where a misfiled card was lost for eternity. You'd never see it again. So there was this huge fuss. I remember going to meetings in Detroit of ALA where people were, you know, almost coming to blows over this AACR2 and its adoption, and what are we going to do about it, and so on and so forth. OCLC under Fred Kilgore took the courageous decision that they would adopt it, but only after a still voice of sanity came up, and that was Arlene Taylor, who, instead of bloviating about what was going on, actually looked at the actual circumstances and looked at the actual effect of implementing AACR2 in a card catalog, and came up, and I'm not sure whether it's your suggestion, I'm sure you'll tell us, that above a certain number of cards, don't change it. Just leave them where they are, put a reference in from the new heading and so on. If it's below a certain number, change them and everyone will be much happier. And that didn't persuade them enough, and it was decided by the Library of Congress and ARL essentially to postpone adoption of the new rules for a year. So we had these perfectly good rules. Well, they weren't perfectly good, but they were much better than what went before. But America's libraries produced hundreds of thousands of records that were not in conformity with that, and were not in conformity with the cataloging that was being done elsewhere in the English-speaking world, because in Britain and in other English-speaking countries, they just adopted the rules and started churning out new records. So there's literally hundreds of thousands of marked records, many of which to this day have never been really brought into conformity with the new rules. So what Charles Martel called the war of AACR2 was like the one that the poet wrote about. You know, he didn't know what it was all about, but it was a famous victory. It was the Battle of Blenheim, I think. But anyway, and the dust and the shouting died, and the captains and the kings departed, and we went on into the 80s. People started talking about AACR3 because the rules didn't deal adequately with computerized records, because they couldn't, because it wasn't known at the time what they were going to be like. But we got AACR2 revised. And all that would have been, that was a minor fuss, but that would have been easier if only we just said, okay, we'll issue a revision of these rules every 10 years. And we'll issue rolling revisions. We'll change chapters and, you know, that kind of stuff. So anyway, there we are. The lessons of it are, it's really hard to do good in this wicked world. Secondly, if you're going to estimate, I'm not talking about RDA because what I've seen of it is complete incoherent mess, but that's my opinion. But I would like somebody, Arlene or some latter-day Arlene, to say, okay, that's an incoherent mess, but if we're saddled with it, what will the impact be? So that we have some actual facts and figures and what needs to be changed and so on, and then people can take rational decisions, which is when all other options are exhausted, what most librarians do. Thank you.